On this podcast, we'll travel to a winery and vineyard that is a special place, an historic property unlike any other. Then we'll swing down to one of our favorite restaurants in San Francisco. Let's go on the wine road.
You know, I've spent a lot of time in Europe, and coming here, you have this idea about California, it's being such a, you know, young wine industry, but really there is a pretty rich history there that a lot of people don't necessarily see.
Greg and I had an idea to do a pizza and wine bar. So next thing you know, I said, Greg, Victoria and I are actually going to do this, and I have to go to Naples and try Neapolitan pizza.
Can you believe that excuse actually worked? We'll meet up with Shelley Lindgren of A16 Restaurant in a little bit. Our first stop is Spring Mountain Vineyard in St. Helena, Napa Valley. Last year, their tasting room manager, Keith, reached out to me via Instagram, because apparently he loves listening to my podcasts, and he invited my wife and I to visit the winery and vineyards, which we did over the holidays. I'm so happy we accepted his invitation, because that was one winery that was off my radar. I thoroughly enjoyed the visit and planned to go back to interview their winemaker, Justin Hirigoyen. What an interesting life he's had, which now continues on Spring Mountain. It was such a nice day. Justin and I sat on the porch of this stunningly beautiful Miravalle Victorian home, the same house that was used, to their chagrin, as the Falcon Crest home from the 1990s TV drama / soap opera, which I had completely forgotten about. Justin shared with me two of their Elevette Bordeaux blends, which were lovely and savory, and a crisp, delightful Sauvignon Blanc. Since he is usually working and not able to enjoy the property like guests get to do, he appreciated the break to sit and look over the vineyard and share some wine. Needless to say, we were quite relaxed.
People always come out and say, wow, a terrible place to work, you know, and I chuckle, but the reality is, I guess we're not sitting out here on the porch every day enjoying the view.
I'm glad to have given you the opportunity to do so.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
What a history this property has with its three distinct vineyards and several historic homes and structures.
It is. It's pretty humbling to work at a place in California that has such a rich history.
Tell us a little bit about each vineyard, the Miravalle, Chateau Chevalier, and the Draper vineyards.
Yeah, I guess I'll kind of start at the top of the mountain and work my way down. But at the top, you have what was historically called the La Perla Vineyard, or the Pearl, which is also known as Draper Vineyards. And that goes back to 1873, was when they acquired the land and started clearing it for planting grapes. So it's actually the first Cabernet that was planted on Spring Mountain. That was acquired by the Draper family in the 40s. The Schilling Spice family was a part of that for a while, but kind of continuously farmed after that kind of initial planting in the late 1870s. And so the Drapers weren't making wine, but they're the ones, you know, where kind of a lot of these different wineries and producers started buying their fruit. And, you know, we've kind of heard through the, I guess through the, if you can accept the pun, through the grapevine, so to speak, that a lot of people really, you know, enjoyed that fruit, and it went into a lot of quality blends. So people know more this property, they recognize it more as the Draper property than La Perla, even though we kind of use that original name. But it has this beautiful stone and redwood winery that dates back to that time. That it's one of my favorite areas on the property. You know, beautiful redwood groves, and you think about, you know, when people first came there, and it would have just been forest, and they were clearing that, you know, by hand, and it's really it's an amazing feat.
Gosh, yeah. And that's the place that has the old winery with a lot of the original equipment and horse-drawn carriages inside, I understand.
That's true, yes. We'd like to see it fixed up a little more, but it's amazing to go back in there, and it's, you know, essentially horse-drawn carriages, and it's, you know, it's a trip. Somebody, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Europe, and coming here, you have this idea about California, it's being such a, you know, young wine industry, but really there is a pretty rich history there that a lot of people don't necessarily see.
Yeah. And there's Chateau Chevalier.
Right. So if you kind of, you know, that's up at about, for us, about 1650 feet in elevation, La Perla, and that comes down to about 1,000. And kind of in that middle range is also Chateau Chevalier. That's how it was known. And, you know, this guy, his name was Fortune Chevalier, a Frenchman. You can't really make up a name like that. And came out here, built this amazing chateau, which is, you know, still in existence. Our current owner kind of refurbished it a bit. And, you know, the family behind Nickel and Nickel owned it for a while, and it changed hands a few times. And really, it became challenging in the 1980s when, you know, phloxer was a big problem, and kind of faced with redeveloping. You know, they replanted, and then they were going to have to replant again. And that was kind of at the time where our current ownership was able to acquire it to kind of make that next step down the mountain.
I have not seen that property yet, but Keith was telling me a little bit about it, and it sounds like it needs some work, but another beautiful structure here on the property.
It is, yeah. And, you know, we're at that place where, you know, we have 845 acres, 225 are planted divine, and all of our focus and attention is going to those planted acres and farming all that. But they did, when they purchased the Chateau Chevalier property in the kind of early to mid-1990s, they refurbished a lot of those structures, and we'd love to see that turned into kind of a wine club venue or something. But it's, you know, I find it, oh, it's almost ostentatious. It's kind of really out there. It's it looks like this chateau kind of just out of place in the middle of California, to be honest. And there's these really old palm trees, and somebody really went all in on the palm trees. But it's a really unique and historic spot.
I guess the palm trees helped make it a California property.
Yeah, they helped bridge that gap.
And then now you have the vineyards around here. I guess the more recent ones that were planted here, which is now, I guess, called Spring Mountain Vineyards, Miravalle.
Yeah, and Miravalle goes back to 1885, at least the construction of the house. And, you know, back in the day, it was much more diverse, where there were thousands of olive trees, there were orchards, there were some vineyards, but, you know, like a lot of places, there was a more diverse focus in what they were doing. But, you know, Tiburcio Parrott built this kind of this mansion, and it's really recognizable. I hate to say the word, you know, Falcon Crest, but a lot of people will recognize the house from the TV show. And we still have a lot of people, especially from various places in Europe, that are ringing our doorbell and wanting to see the Falcon Crest house. So we'll get that out of the way early on, that's certainly part of the history. And, you know, I'm of a generation where I didn't necessarily grow up watching it, but I've had a great time watching some of the YouTube videos and having a good laugh.
It is an incredible house when you walk around through there, and it's well adorned and designed inside, and it's just stunningly beautiful.
It is, and it's pretty much all original. So it's all original stained glass, original wood flooring, and the woodwork is really impressive. Our current owner added on some of the crown molding, but essentially it's kind of in its original state and really, really well preserved. We have to, in old property, you always have to, there's upkeep, but it's a beautiful, beautiful building.
Yeah, it's interesting. The story of Tiburcio Parrott, it fits pretty well with the TV drama Falcon Crest, you know, a soap opera, because he lived a bit of a scandalous life himself, didn't he?
He did. A lot of these, you know, kind of larger-than-life characters. But he was, you know, what's interesting about his history that I like to focus on is he was a big champion of kind of using immigrant labor, and at a time when, you know, people weren't, you weren't supposed to be employing, you know, Chinese immigrants or, you know, that workforce. He was a big advocate for them and actually spent some time in jail for employing people. And that's the workforce that built. There's a cave that we still use today that goes back to the same time. It was a storage area for the house, actually, 1885. And that was all dug out by hand using kind of the Chinese labor force. And he really, you know, went all the way to California Supreme Court, and he was really a big advocate for that force.
Yeah, I would think with a name like Tiburcio Parrott, you couldn't avoid being a larger-than-life character. As we talk about the property, I hope we've been able to capture the magnitude of the history and stunning elements of this estate. And then there's the wine. Well, starting this year, for the first time, they begin bottling vineyard designate wines from each individual site.
We are, yeah. We're not going all in on the first vintage, so we're going to start with La Perla, but it's something that, you know, as we've, you know, I'm coming on my fifth year here. Our vineyard manager has been here for 15 years, and as we spend more time with the property, we're really interested in how the different areas, what their characteristics are, and how those wines will change over time. So historically, we've been making two wines, kind of a pretty traditional Bordeaux model, where we've got kind of the flagship wine or a reserve wine, if you will, which for us is Elivet, which is a Bordeaux blend. And we've been making our estate Cabernet, which is, you know, kind of our second tier. But those are our blends. And so right now we have 135 vineyard blocks across those kind of three historic properties that we've been talking about, and all five Bordeaux varieties. And those are being blended into two wines. So it's really interesting to have all those tools in your toolkit when you're blending. And it's really advantageous to have that diversity. And it helps us through vintages. You know, certain blocks will do better in different vintages. But we're also interested in, I guess you could say it's more of a Burgundian model, where we're interested in how those specific, you know, at the parcel level, what the qualities and characteristics are of those specific vineyards and how they differ over time. Because it is a pretty expansive property, and I think there's room to showcase a lot of the kind of individual areas of the property.
I'm sure you'll be able to taste the differences between the three.
There are certain, I mean, there's, you know, even within, you know, their historic vineyards, even within those, you know, block to block or upper section, lower section, there's a great diversity. But it's not just, you know, this is different than that and we don't really care and we want to blend it. It's, you know, this is actually really compelling on its own, and we want to see how that ages over time.
When the current owner purchased the property in 92, it caught my eye that part of the purchase included the library vintages, and you still have plenty of those on hand. You'll break them out and sell them too.
Yeah, our current owner is a big wine collector, you know, wine aficionado, and he was a fan of the wines before he acquired the property. I mean, it's really easy to fall in love with this place when you visit and you go up the mountain. It's just, you know, it's really second to none. But one of the things that's unique about this property is the ageability of the wines, and he was really diligent about holding back a certain percentage of each vintage so that we would then be able to age it and then taste it and drink it when it's ready to go. And that's something that, you know, we're really thankful for, and it's something that we try and continue today.
Yeah, it's nice that he doesn't have that pressure to make sales. It seems like he'll do it when he's ready to release them.
Yeah, he can put the pressure on us and not have to worry about it. So we do a mix for people who come and visit the property of current stuff and older stuff, so we don't deplete that, you know, so much, because it's one of our greatest kind of assets, and it's this really unique kind of historical snapshot of a place to be able to go back and see vintage after vintage, how the wines are holding up. You know, maybe they're in an open phase or a closed phase, and, you know, it's not always this kind of linear progression in winemaking and aging wines.
Today, you've opened an 05 and a 15 of the Élevette, along with your Sauvignon Blanc from 16. But when I was here before with Keith a few months ago, we had the, I think it was the 88 Spring Mountain blend, and that was just divine.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's before, that's a different owner, it's a different winemaking regime, but still there's a common thread throughout the wines, and you find that at these great sites, that place ends up showing through in the end, and consistently trained sommeliers will peg these wines at least a decade younger than they actually are.
Since we're talking about vintages, can I ask you how old you are? Because you seem like you're pretty young.
Thank you. Yes, I'm in my early 30s. I'm 31.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been here since 2014. So we were talking before this that, you know, after a few years of making wine kind of year after year and seeing different vintages, you know, you're only scratching the surface at a property like this after, you know, call it five vintages. And as I mentioned, I rely a lot on our vineyard manager, who's been here for 15, and he's been in St. Helena kind of all his life. And so great sounding board for me for making sure that we have a great context to what we're doing.
What a difference having him here on hand, and he's been here for such a long time and seen the changes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday, coming in 2014, and I was pretty much fresh off the boat from Burgundy, which is very different from California winemaking, especially Bordeaux varieties here. And there was a lot of driving around. You know, I arrived in August, and so harvest was knocking at the door, especially in 14, which was a drought vintage for us. And what block is this, and what variety and clone, and what's the soil again, and just trying to pick his brain as much as possible. And we fortunately get along really well, and Ron's, you know, a huge part of this property and of the resulting wines.
There's so much to learn. I mean, gosh, you must be just inundated with information when you first take a job like this, and you got acres and acres to deal with, and these properties kind of in the back of your mind too, these structures that are part of the whole thing.
Absolutely. I mean, fortunately and unfortunately, I'm a bit obsessive with my, you know, preparation and my learning. And okay, there's definitely that initial stage where you've got to get everything down and cataloged and evaluated. And the best guide is pulling out older vintages and looking at the growing season and looking at what blocks went into those blends and what was the oak regime, and, you know, using that historical base and using Ron as a sounding board, and also, you know, trusted kind of people in the industry. When I started, I wasn't all alone here. You know, we had Patrick Leon, who's the one who hired me into this project, and he was, you know, at Mouton for 20 years, and he was just a wealth of knowledge for context and for blending and for, you know, just constantly asking the right questions. And he was a big influence. He actually recently passed away, so we wish his family the best. But he was a big influence on the winemaking program here starting in 2010, and we kind of continue to carry that torch forward, that attention to detail and that rigor in what we try and do.
I was going to ask you if you feel a weight or a sense of undeniable responsibility as the winemaker for a place with such a deep and rich history.
Absolutely. I mean, it's you want to be able to carry that torch forward, and you want to build on the consistency that they already have and work on that precision.
Hmm. I just had a very friendly vineyard cat jump on my lap. Hi. Who's sticking her tail in my glass?
Biodiversity, that's what we preach here. Oh, you know, yeah. So natural systems, we encourage the natural control here.
But you do have, getting back to your responsibility and your history, you do have some French blood in your veins, and you spent some time in Bordeaux, and you also mentioned Burgundy following college. So you seem like a good fit.
Yeah, we like to pretend that spending time in France prepares you for a place like this. But, you know, I'm a big proponent of just continual learning. And I'm French-American, well, Basque French. You know, I have to, some of my friends in the Basque region would get angry if I didn't mention that. French Basque, you know, not purely just French. So we like to, you know, segregate ourselves a little bit. But, you know, there's a rich history of winemaking over there, and I was very fortunate to be able to spend time over there and learn from, you know, some really great winemakers and property owners, and, you know, just, you know, friends over there who, you know, taught me a lot of the skills that I have been able to employ here.
And you were fortunate enough to be able to learn wine and food at an early age because your father is a restaurateur, and he's the Frenchman in the family. He's a chef. And so, boy, having that around you throughout your childhood and your early youth, there's a wealth of information there.
Certainly. And it's a great fit for the wines that we make here, because these are really wines that you should be opening at the dinner table and enjoying with friends and family. And that was really what drew me initially to this industry, was these just really great long extended dinners with great food and friends and family and great wines that kind of piqued my interest. And I always had this interest in chemistry, being outside, working with my hands, and there's a great mix in winemaking between kind of that analytical portion, you know, the spreadsheets, the data, the chemistry, but also being able to kind of put that aside and, you know, use your palate, use your intuition, use your creativity to, you know, build on that foundation of science. So it was a great mix for me, and I certainly have to thank my dad for introducing me to, you know, great wine and great food as well.
So do you see Spring Mountain Vineyard as a place that where you will grow deep roots, possibly spend much of your career here?
It's a place that it's hard to imagine leaving. I'm never bored. Every day is a challenge. It's different. I'm continually learning. So it's something that, you know, it's like these great properties that are in, you know, families for generations in Europe. It's something that is more unique in California, but it's certainly something, and we were kind of mentioning this beforehand, but it's a really exciting time here, and we're A lot of the original vineyards that didn't get put in that first wave of redevelopment, because our current owner did replant almost everything in the early 90s when he acquired the properties. But a lot of that stuff is, it's now time, even though the wine is spectacular, it's hardly producing, and it's time to redevelop all that. So we're embarking right now on an ambitious redevelopment program that's really exciting to be able to make some of the decisions for vine material and plant something that's going to be here for at least the next 30 years.
I know it's important to put some of the financial backing into the winemaking side, but I love some of the ideas that I've heard about hospitality side by bringing some of these properties up to a level where you can have events there. And because they are so unique and in several different places around this property, I would love to see that. I think it'd be very engaging and interesting to people.
I think like all great projects, it's about actualizing our potential here. And one of our greatest assets are these historical buildings. And it's something that, you know, farming and winemaking is a really capital intensive business, but it's something that we'd like to see, you know, something kind of carved out if we can to refurbish these historic buildings and see them, you know, open them up so that people can see them and appreciate them and enjoy wine tastings and, you know, events and, you know, think back to what it must have been like to construct these properties and enjoy that part of it as well.
Well, Justin, I certainly appreciate your time, and I'm respectful of what you're doing here and somewhat envious.
Well, I appreciate that. It's been fun talking to you, and it's such a special place that it's really great to be able to share it with other people and with the world.
Justin and I talked for quite a while longer after the interview about his colorful past and the wine industry while drinking their fantastic Cabernet and Élevette Reserve blends. And actually, he was gravitating to the Sauvignon Blanc. His father's restaurant in San Francisco is Piperade on Battery. If you'd like to try some French and Spanish Basque food with Spring Mountain wine, check out the rich history of the winery at springmountainvineyard.com. Up next, we travel to a restaurant in San Francisco, coincidentally, A16 Restaurant, when we continue on the wine road. We're back on the wine road. Now the second part of today's podcast. A few years ago, I moderated a panel called Women and Wine. One of the eight panelists was Shelley Lindgren, who is part owner and wine director of A16 Restaurant in San Francisco. I was impressed with her resume. She worked in restaurants for many years. Then after graduating from the University of San Francisco, she spent 6 years at the fine dining restaurant La Fleur de Lis while earning her sommelier certificate. She also earned a culinary certificate at the Tante Marie Cooking School, where she then taught for 12 years. But 3 years after graduation, she and some friends, with help from family, opened A16 Restaurant. It's known for Neapolitan pizza and Italian wine, but that wasn't quite the original plan.
It was funny because we were going to do pizza and wine, and I was a sommelier at a restaurant called Bacar with Debbie Zacharias. And I had run into my business partner, Victoria, who is one of those really bright, smart people that remembers everything she ever ate. Everything. So Greg and I had an idea to do a pizza and wine bar, and we had looked at other spaces before, and then I ran into Victoria, and she said, there's really no Neapolitan pizza, and I didn't know what it was. I said, well, tell me about it. Yeah, what is that? So next thing you know, I said, Greg, Victoria and I are actually going to do this, and I have to go to Naples and try Neapolitan pizza.
That sounds like you're just searching for a reason to go back to Italy.
And
I'm sure you could have looked that up somewhere.
You know, if you're going to do it right or do it, you know, as close as you can. And we had met our original chef, Christoph Hill. He became a partner here because his task was to go to Campania, learn the local cuisine, and to figure out the pizza was front and center. It was pizza first is how it evolved, and wine.
Explain to us what makes a pizza Neapolitan.
Okay, so it takes about 72 hours to proof the dough.
Wow.
And so you have a really active yeast, very alive. The oven's hot. It's about 800 degrees and cooks in about 90 seconds. But so we want high heat and something that's really kind of a quick thing. And actually, what happened last week is Neapolitan pizza became a UNESCO cultural heritage because the Italians voted for pizza to be one of the most pizza from Naples to be one of the most culturally identifiable products. So it's that important to Italians. We take it seriously that we're wanting to do the best we can with it here. It was on that trip also, we were going to have all Italian wine lists. And after going to those trips, you realize there's so many fantastic local grapes that you really want to highlight those with the food. Something like this one in the sparkling red wine glass.
What is that?
We haven't sipped it yet, but it's it comes from indigenous grapes from Vesuvius and Amalfi from Gragnano, which is a really famous pasta. One of the most famous dried pastas. It's right off the, just above Sorrento, on your way to Amalfi. And it's a naturally frizzante wine that's a perfect match for the tomato sauce in a marinara pizza.
No wonder you have the reputation for seeking out the rare Italian varietals, because you do it so well.
Well, I think that I believe in our customers and people, and that if you're going to do something, do the best you can do, and not like trying to say this is what people want. Let's just give them this when you know that there's so many things. And you know, we just spend a lot of time putting together the food and wine that we think goes really well together. And there's a lot of quality and value in Southern Italy.
So are you serving local winemakers wine as well, the ones that grow Italian varietals?
Oh yeah. When we first opened, I really tried to do Calitale. There's always been a presence because a lot of the farmers in California have Italian backgrounds. And so today you can find great winemakers like Megan and Ryan Glab from Rhyme, and they do Vermentino and Rubola Gialla. And most of the Rubola Gialla is coming from George Vera's vineyard that he's passed away. He was such a great inspiration, but he fell in love with this grape and planted it above Silverado Trail and really had a vision. And then there is a lot of old vine Italian grapes that are being sought after by these really passionate winemakers that aren't trying to make, they're trying to make wines that they love and they want to make. And, right. and the customers are saying that's really an exciting direction for California. And yeah, at first, one of the things I had struggled with was I would thought Sangiovese, since it's so widely planted in Italy, that it would be great in California, and it's been really hard to find. But we have a Nebbiolo from Palmina by the Glass. Next week we'll have Clendenin families, Nebbiolo by the Glass. We have a Vermentino from Rhyme, and it's just a growing area. But even grapes like Gamay or Cab Franc, or just have some diversity, is exciting because those are great for food, a Mediterranean cuisine like we have.
I mentioned earlier that I was impressed with her resume. Another accolade to add to the list, she has a cookbook that gained quite a bit of recognition.
It's so exciting because we, on our, both for A16 and SPQR, we did half wine and half food because it was a restaurant book. And so, you only have so much space you could talk about what you want to, but we covered all the regions in Italy between the two cookbooks for wine. And then Kate Leahy, who's a co-author, that was her first cookbook after she went to get her master's in journalism at Northwestern. And my friend Amanda, who's now the test kitchen director at Williams-Sonoma, she did all the recipe testing. So they're foolproof. You can use them at home. The recipes work. And also,
is foolproof a prerequisite for recipes in a book? I guess you would want them to be, huh?
Through the book, you'll find classic recipes of Campania, the region we focus on. And we were so lucky because it was really well received. And we got the Cookbook of the Year from IACP and the Julia Child Award for that, which still hasn't resonated that sunk in, because we have so much respect for so many authors out there.
That's fantastic. And I didn't even ask, what's the name of the cookbook?
Oh, A16 Food and Wine and SPQR Food and Wine.
Now explain to our listeners why you chose the names A16 and SPQR.
So imagine right before you could have Google Maps and be in Italy, like now you could Instagram from the top of Vesuvius if you wanted to, but the roads in Southern Italy are pretty remote. So we were driving around with these huge maps open in the car, and we kept finding ourselves on the main thoroughfare, which is A16, and it's the autostrada that goes from Naples to Canosa, north of Bari, and sort of transverses across the southern Italy right there.
Sounds reasonable to choose a highway that's right in the center of where you want to focus your love and passion for food and wine. So why not A16? Where's your other A16 restaurant?
In Rockridge. We opened almost two years ago. So we have a bit more space there. We put in a great Neapolitan wood-burning oven. That's been really fun for us. We tiled it and have a little bit more space, a full bar.
The SPQR is from a Roman or even Latin saying.
Right, the Senate and people of Rome, K. Romanus. That came about because it's a very small restaurant, very cozy, and we thought it seemed... like an urban setting, because you go to Rome, you're not usually able to see a lot of space. You're just making the most with what you have, and that's how it felt. And so we thought, we always love Rome. It's our favorite city, and we just went that direction.
And SPQR is more centrally located?
It's right over on sort of lower Pack Heights, upper Fillmore, that area, which has been going through a great renaissance since the past 5 years. Lots of new shopping and restaurants there. So we opened there in 2007, September. And then Matthew, he was able to achieve a Michelin star the past 3 years for our small little place. And that's been really exciting. And this year he's up for James Beard Best of the West Chef. We're super excited.
How many times have you been nominated for a James Beard Award?
This will be the sixth year for wine at A16. and I'm excited because I've never been to Chicago, and I've already been in touch with so many great people in our industry that just to be nominated is more than we could ever have hoped for.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're doing something right. Keep up the great work. And we'd met a few weeks ago, but didn't really talk in depth. So I'm glad I had a chance to actually sit down and talk with you about your past.
No, thank you.
I'm sure we'll be back.
I hope so.
And we have been back to A16 a couple of times and have since been to SPQR. What a fantastic Michelin star restaurant. And by the way, A16 has more than just pizza. And the seven or so wines we tasted were outstanding. A16 is just north of Lombard at Divisadero and Chestnut, so it's real easy to get to if you're coming from the North Bay. They're also in Oakland. The websites are a16pizza.com and spqrsf.com. If you're listening to this on iTunes, Stitcher, or another podcast provider, you can find more interviews and interesting content on my website, onthewineroad.com. I'm on Facebook as On the Wine Road and Instagram and Twitter at JD Wine Road. If you'd like to join my wine community, look for me on Patreon. There I provide compelling tidbits you won't find elsewhere, and I give you tempting incentives as a patron. That's patreon.com/onthewineroad. Patreon is Patreon. Thank you for your continued support and keeping me company on the wine road.